Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 22nd of March, these are our main stories. America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, says there's consensus between Washington and its Arab allies on the need for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In a landmark lawsuit, the US Department of Justice has accused Apple of illegally monopolizing the smartphone market. The RSF paramilitary group in Sudan has rejected a deal that would have made it easier for much-needed aid to reach Darfur. Also in this podcast,
his vital signs are very stable. Because this is a kidney transplant, we monitor his urine output. He's making tons of urine. He's doing very well.
We hear about the man who's received a kidney from a genetically modified pig in the first transplant of its kind. The sight of America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, in the Middle East has become a familiar one in recent months. But after holding talks in Egypt with Arab leaders and the war in Gaza, he spoke emotionally about the dire humanitarian situation in the Palestinian territory and said there was agreement between the US and Arab nations that there had to be an immediate ceasefire.
Children should not be dying of malnutrition in Gaza or anywhere else for that matter. 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity. We must not allow that to continue. The ceasefire that we're working on would be the best, most immediate way to enable us to surge humanitarian assistance, but it's not the only way. And as I said, we need to really surge and sustain the assistance across land, across sea, and across air.
The US says it will bring a draft resolution to the UN Security Council on Friday that ties the need for an immediate ceasefire with the release of hostages held by Hamas. It has previously blocked similar resolutions. Our correspondent, Tom Bateman, listened as Mr. Blinken gave his comments in the Egyptian capital. And as soon as the camera lights were switched off, he filed this report from a busy room full of journalists.
Well, this news conference has just wrapped up with Antony Blinken and the Egyptian foreign minister. That now concludes this part of Antony Blinken's trip before he heads to Tel Aviv on Friday morning. But what we heard from him here was really reiterating that language that we now know is in this Security Council draft resolution that is to be put to the vote by the US. He talked about the need for an immediate ceasefire linked to the release of hostages. So this is the key point about what the Americans are talking about now, is that they want to get that vote through, but it really just endorses the process that has been going on in Doha to try and get a ceasefire and the release of hostages. That indirect negotiation between Israel and Hamas in Qatar, currently no signs of a breakthrough with that. And another notable moment in this news conference from the Egyptian foreign minister, when he really gave Antony Blinken a ticking off. He talked about the double standards of the international community, I think notably meaning the US, in terms of the international rules-based system. He said, suggested it was being undermined, that there was a moral imperative to hold to the international rules of conflict everywhere in the world. And in this case, he was implying clearly it wasn't it wasn't. And this is something that the West was helping to perpetrate. So that was quite a significant moment, I thought, in this news conference. So from here, Antony Blinken heads to Tel Aviv Friday morning. And it's going to be, I think, a moment of the Americans putting pressure on the Israelis over those key issues, flooding more aid into Gaza amid the humanitarian crisis, and also about their objection to a full-scale ground assault in the city of Rafah. So a relationship that is often described as ironclad, I think we're going to see a moment of more stress points emerging on Friday.
Tom Bateman in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Well, more than 5 months of war in the densely populated Gaza Strip have led to severe food shortages and starvation. The US has repeatedly called on Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into the territory, but has also carried out airdrops. The head of the World Health Organization said only opening more border crossings for trucks carrying aid could prevent famine in the territory. Meanwhile, fighting has been continuing around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, which is crowded with patients and people who have been displaced. Ala Aboukas, who's trapped in the hospital complex, spoke to the BBC about what happened when the Israeli soldiers searched the building.
I swear by God, they just take those who they consider to be saboteurs of the Hamas movement. It's been 2 days without any water, food or electricity, and people are on top of each other in complete darkness in the corridors. There are thousands of displaced people. We are starved and dehydrated and living in fear and terror. There were tanks and soldiers all around us, and they were firing above and around us to frighten the elderly and the children.
Israel says its raid on the hospital over the past few days has killed more than 140 fighters. News agencies have shown pictures with streams of people fleeing south from the hospital along Gaza's coast. At the same time, the BBC has confirmed that a spokesman for Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been suspended because of a dispute with the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron. Alon Levy has been a leading Israeli government voice since the conflict with Hamas erupted. From Jerusalem, Mark Lowen sent this report.
Educated at Oxford, 33-year-old Alon Levy became a face of Israel's public diplomacy in English following the Hamas attack of the 7th of October. His style, seen by some as pugnacious, others as rude, made him a prominent attack dog in the media. But he recently turned his sights on the Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, who had posted a statement calling for Israel to allow more aid into Gaza, adding that Britain hadn't seen an improvement on the ground. Mr. Levy shot back, calling it factually incorrect, claiming aid trucks had doubled since before the war and that Israel had gone further than any country in history to facilitate delivery to enemy territory. The BBC has now confirmed that the British Foreign Office expressed surprise to the Israeli Foreign Ministry, diplomacy for annoyance, and asked whether he reflected official policy. Mr. Levy was swiftly suspended. It's thought he was already in the bad books of Sarah Netanyahu, the Prime Minister's wife, for attending anti-government marches before the October attack. Amidst growing international exasperation with Israel over the offensive in Gaza, it seems the Israeli government decided a punchy messenger wasn't helping.
Mark Lowen. The US is accusing the tech giant Apple of monopolising the smartphone market in a landmark lawsuit against the company. At a news conference, the US Attorney General Merrick Garland said Apple was using its market dominance to hurt rivals, developers and customers.
We allege that Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers. For consumers, that has meant fewer choices, higher prices and fees, lower quality smartphones, apps and accessories, and less innovation from Apple and its competitors. For developers, that has meant being forced to play by rules that insulate Apple from competition. And as outlined in our complaint, we allege that Apple has consolidated its monopoly power not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse.
Apple said the case was wrong on the facts and the law and that it would vigorously defend itself. The tech company has also faced legal action from regulators elsewhere, including in the European Union, Japan and South Korea. Rahul Tandon spoke to our New York business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, and asked her, is the Biden administration really taking on big tech?
I think it's reminiscent to the case against Microsoft back in the 90s. It's going to take a long time before we see any resolution of this. It is also not the first time that the Department of Justice has crossed hairs with Apple. I think it's the third time they've kind of been sued for an illegal monopoly over the past 14 years. But this is the key product. We're talking about an illegal monopoly over smartphones. This is, the main moneymaker for Apple for a very long time. They are accused of stifling competition. They are accused of blocking super apps, of suppressing mobile cloud streaming. They're accused of limiting how well third-party smartwatches work across its platform. So it is going to have a widespread impact on this company, and it is going to be one that Apple is going to fight tooth and nail.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because it was earlier this month that we had the EU fining Apple over 1.8 billion euros because of App Store restrictions. We've seen this action in the EU. Now we have this case in the US. Is it a coordinated attempt by the authorities to tackle the likes of Apple?
I think what we're seeing is increasing scrutiny of giant tech companies, not just Apple. We're seeing it also with Google and others. It just all seems to be kind of coming to a head at the same moment. Don't forget, you've got Apple also is engaged in another kind of war of words with the maker of the Fortnite game, again, over excessive fees that the game maker says Apple charges them. That is something that's been working its way through the case, aside from, as you mentioned, these other antitrust cases, both in Europe, but also here in the United States. The question is, what happens next? Will this detract Apple from kind of, its sort of day-to-day focus? If you look at sort of what went on with Microsoft, this lasted for years. So it'll be interesting to watch how this plays out. But again, they've made the point that things like the Apple Watch works better with an iPhone than other brands. And it's all about how Apple locks out competitors. For its part, Apple obviously is pushing back vigorously, saying that, this will harm their business going forward and their ability to kind of make products that consumers love.
Michelle Fleury. A 62-year-old man in Boston in the US has received a kidney from a genetically engineered pig in the first transplant of its kind. Surgeons at Massachusetts General Hospital say if such procedures are carried out on a large scale, dialysis, which is used to treat kidney failure, could become obsolete. In the past, pig kidneys have been put into brain-dead people as a test. Richard Slademan, whose previously transplanted human kidney began to fail last year, is recovering well after the four-hour surgery last week. Every day in the US, 17 people die waiting for a kidney transplant. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Dr. Winfried Williams, who was on the surgical team that performed Mr. Slayman's operation. So how is the patient?
I just left his bedside, and he's doing spectacularly well. He is up and about. He's actually has a visitor there. His cousin is visiting him as we speak, and he's in very good spirits. We've been, of course, monitoring him very closely. His vital signs are very stable. He's making, because this is a kidney transplant, we monitor his urine output. He's making tons of urine. He's doing very well.
Goodness me. And this is just a few days after surgery.
Yes. Well, on that score, in fact, when we were in the OR at the end of the four-hour surgery, when the vessels were unclamped and the kidney was perfused, on the table, when the ureter was held up, he was immediately making urine. It was really astounding.
It's been a long road for this particular patient. I just want to get to the science of using a genetically modified pig to do this complete transplant of an entire organ. Just first of all, why was it so important for the pig to be genetically modified? Because this is crucial as to whether or not this is actually going to work, isn't it?
Because we as human beings, when you look at cross-species, responses to a xenoallograft, this is what a cross-species transplant, a xenotransplant, we have natural antibodies against pig tissue surface markers. And so the first genetic modification is to take out these natural, they're actually glycoproteins on the pig kidney surface and in their vasculature to remove them genetically so that we don't have an immediate, it's called hyperacute rejection episode. So the first modification is to take out these surface antigen markers, these glycoproteins that our bodies recognize naturally as foreign.
Because this is the sticking point that many people may have issues with, that it could be seen, many people might worry that there could be a genetic issue, a contamination, that by introducing animal organs to merge with humans, we may actually invent new problems that could affect not just that particular patient.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the other part here, so there's three genetic modifications here, if you look at a series of genetic modifications. So there are a huge array of these virus gene editing that occur just to make sure that we're not transmitting a virus unintentionally to the human recipient.
So we hope that this could be a gateway into a whole new world of medicine, which could potentially help thousands of people living on kidney dialysis. What's the great hope with what you've done here?
The great hope is that this would actually represent a milestone that would change the very nature of how we perform kidney transplantation worldwide, but certainly here in the United States. There are 100,000 patients on the waiting list. We only do on the order of 20, 25,000 transplants a year. So the demand far outstrips the supply of donor organs. This could change that entire construct. You would be virtually able, because of this new technology, to take a kidney off the shelf if it's needed and implant it immediately into patients who have end-stage renal disease.
Dr. Winfried Williams. Still to come on the podcast.
When you dress people like I do, I know everything about them. How often you wear the suit, whether you're cold or hot, it's going to wrinkle too much.
A Holocaust survivor who went on to become a tailor for six US presidents and several celebrities has died at the age of 95.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A prominent opposition leader in India has been arrested by the Financial Crimes Agency as the world's largest democracy is gearing up to vote in elections which will be held in April and May. Police surrounded the home of Delhi's chief minister, Arvind Kejriwal, a leading figure in an opposition alliance which is challenging the party of the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi in the polls. Mr. Kejriwal's supporters say his arrest is politically motivated. Our reporter, Dilnawaz Pasha, spoke to us from outside the chief minister's home in Delhi.
In a very significant development, Delhi chief minister Arvind Kejriwal was arrested by the Enforcement Directorate today. The arrest comes in connection with the money laundering probe related to the excises policy case. Prior to his arrest, the Enforcement Directorate officials conducted searches at his official residence in New Delhi. We are told by his party members and ministers of his government that he has been detained, but there is no official confirmation as of now from the authorities.
And his supporters are saying that this is part of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's efforts to sideline opponents ahead of elections, which are due to be held in a few weeks' time.
I am here at the residence and I have spoken to several of his supporters. They all are saying this arrest is politically motivated and the Prime Minister is afraid of the coming general elections, which are 2 months away from now. In Delhi, the elections are going to happen on 25th of May. So many of his supporters are saying that the current Prime Minister, which is seen as a very strong leader and who is claiming to come with more than 2/3 majority in the parliament, is afraid of Arvind Kejriwal, and that is why he has been arrested. But if we look at the facts of this case, things are a bit different from what is supporters believe. The enforcement director, which is the investigative agency in this case, says it has a very strong case against the chief minister. And prior to the arrest of the chief minister, several ministers of his government are already in jail in connection to this alleged scam.
But he's not the only opposition leader to be caught up in a criminal investigation. And opposition parties in India are saying that Mr. Modi's Hindu nationalist government is misusing government agencies for political ends to try to stop his opponents challenging him.
Yeah, that is a very common allegation by the opposition parties. And the fact is, in last 2 months, I am covering the arrest of a second chief minister by Enforcement Directorate. And it's not a coincidence that both of them are opposition leaders. The opposition parties are in an alliance against Prime Modi's party. And prior to the election, several high-profile arrests have happened. So yes, many political commentators also believe that these arrests and all these actions by the investigative agencies against the opposition leaders are politically motivated.
Dilnawaz Pasha in Delhi. Aid agencies have been warning the civil war in Sudan could become the world's worst hunger crisis, with millions of people on the brink of famine. So the military government has reached a deal with the UN to bring in more humanitarian aid to Darfur, one of the regions that's seen the heaviest fighting. But despite the suffering of the huge numbers of people who've been displaced, maimed, raped or starved, the deal has been rejected by the paramilitary group fighting the army, the Rapid Support Forces, which controls much of Darfur. Our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, told us more about the devastating consequences of the war which erupted nearly a year ago.
It has been called one of the world's largest displacement crises. So we have people displaced multiple times inside Sudan itself. And then there are those who have made it across the border into neighboring countries. And the situation is just getting worse by day. There's no end in sight to the fighting. And it has disrupted people's lives, livelihoods. The farmers have not been able to farm, and therefore there's hunger in the country. And the World Food Programme is warning that going into the lean season, starting around May, they could enter the highest levels of hunger, which is called the catastrophic hunger.
We're talking about something like 25 million people. I think that's the figure I've seen quoted. So there's been this deal struck between the military government and the United Nations to try to get more humanitarian aid. So why has the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group, which is fighting the government, rejected this deal?
It's all about control. In February, the army, which is the de facto government in Sudan at the moment, blocked the border from Chad in the western side of the country into Darfur. Well, that's where humanitarian aid has been coming in through in Darfur. And then they blocked that border to a vast area that's controlled by the Rapid Support Forces, because they say, they've made accusations that arms are being smuggled to their rivals, the RSF. After negotiations, they agreed to reopen one border, which is to an area that the army controls. But the vast part of Darfur is controlled by the RSF. Now, there have been talks ongoing between the different sides and the UN. And yesterday it was announced that there had been breakthrough, that one more route was going to be reopened. And that is from Port Sudan, which is the port city by the Red Sea, via the northern state down to the western side, that is Darfur. And, you know, these are areas which the army controls. And RSF came out today to say that they reject that agreement, and they level the same accusation that has been leveled against them, that it may be used to smuggle arms to rearm the army after it had lost much of Darfur.
And Soy, the Ukrainian president has warned EU leaders they need to act quickly to send more ammunition to Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking via video link, said the amount of artillery shells available to Ukrainian soldiers was humiliating for the whole of Europe. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has reaffirmed his support for a plan to use the profits from hundreds of billions of dollars of frozen Russian assets to pay for more weapons for Ukraine. Our Europe regional editor Alice Adley reports.
President Zelensky told the leaders of the 27 countries in the EU that this was Russia's war, not only against Ukraine, but against all of their countries as well, against the whole of Europe and the European way of life. He said he was grateful for the help that had been provided so far, but called for more air defences, enough to protect his whole country, and for more artillery. Ukraine has been suffering from dwindling supplies of weapons and ammunition while it waits for a US financial aid package, which remains blocked by Republicans in Congress. EU leaders have been discussing plans to use revenues from frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine's military. The funds were blocked in retaliation for Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. As he arrived for the summit in Brussels, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said Russia had no right to the money.
This is about the earnings, which no one is entitled to, and therefore can be used by the European Union. And, as far as I'm concerned, they should first and foremost be used to buy the ammunition Ukraine needs for its defence.
Reacting to the European plans, President Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov warned that Russia would fight back with all means necessary. Meanwhile, the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who is sympathetic to Moscow, broke ranks and congratulated the Russian President Vladimir Putin on his re-election, which has been widely condemned in the West as undemocratic.
Alice Adley. For people who are paralysed, it's a source of hope that they'll be able to once again do the things they used to. The first patient to receive a brain chip from Elon Musk's company Neuralink has been shown apparently playing online chess. 29-year-old Noland Arbour, who's paralysed below the shoulders, received the chip implant in January.
So a lot of what we started out with was attempting to move. So I would attempt to move, say, my right hand, left, right, forward. And from there, I think it just became intuitive for me to start imagining the cursor moving. Basically, it was like using the force on a cursor, and I could get it to move wherever I wanted, just stare somewhere in the screen, and it would move where I wanted it to.
Other billionaires like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos are also investing heavily in this technology, which could one day allow paralyzed people to control devices through thought alone. Mariska von Steensel is a neuroscientist at the University Medical Center Utrecht Brain Center in the Netherlands and president of the International Brain Computer Interface Society. She has concerns about how Neuralink is developing the technology.
People with quadriplegia, so complete paralysis from the shoulders below, being able to control their computer in an adequate fashion and thereby have autonomy in their lives and interact with others, but also just make use of a computer the way that able-bodied people can do. I think that's a great benefit. But this type of technology is also being developed for people who can no longer speak, allowing them to use their brain signals to communicate. So that's yet another target population of these kind of technologies. Of course, Neuralink is not the only company that is working on new technologies to read brain signals and to do something useful with those brain signals. There are other companies working in this space, but usually those companies collaborate with academic researchers, with medical centers, you know, to run their studies and to collect research data that is then published in peer-reviewed papers. We know very little, basically nothing, about how Neuralink is handling this. Do they collaborate with an academic research center, with a medical hospital? Do they build their own hospital? We don't know. And not having publications on the data, or even better, shared data, will make it more difficult for the rest of the BCI community to assess the value of the system compared to the other developments out there.
Neuroscientist Mariska von Steensel. A Holocaust survivor who went on to become a tailor for six US presidents, the singer Frank Sinatra and the actor Leonardo DiCaprio, has died at the age of 95. As a teenager, Martin Greenfield was imprisoned at the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. He was the only member of his family to survive the Holocaust. Molly Perella looks back at his life.
Born into a Jewish family, Martin Greenfield was taken to Auschwitz in 1944. He was taught to sew by a fellow prisoner after he accidentally ripped a guard shirt. He mended it and wore it under his prison uniform. Other prisoners thought it signified that he had special privileges. Decades later, Mr. Greenfield wrote in his memoir that it was this that taught him that clothes possess power. He spoke about his life in a 2018 documentary.
When you dress people like I do, I know everything about them. how often you wear the suit, whether your coat or hat is going to wrinkle too much. I'm a suit doctor, not a medical doctor.
Mr. Greenfield was freed after about a year at the concentration camp. With $10 in his pocket, he boarded a ship to New York. He went on to set up a very successful business with clients including the last three US presidents, Barack Obama, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Mr. Greenfield was widely regarded as the best men's tailor in the United States, but he never forgot the horrors of Auschwitz and what he'd lost.
The pain is still in my heart about my family. I still dream about my family.
Mr. Greenfield's sons said he survived the atrocities of the Holocaust with his humanity intact and that his infectious smile left a positive impression on everyone he met.
That report by Molly Perella. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.